the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So today, grieving rituals globally across all borders for all in grief, including the earth herself. Salam shalom, as Deborah Falmouth often reminds us, peace is not the absence of conflict, but the presence of oneness. Tyranny always seeks to destroy community and then creates the toxic mimic, which is a cult. So we are here in our council to animate community arising from the earth across all borders. Community be dedicated to collective well-being, freedom, democracy, and a cult be a prison. So today we are offering dedicated voices. It's me curating here, including Ally Rabbi Irwin Keller, great, wonderful being. And next week's guest, Shambhavi Sarasvati, with her bold essay that I'll be reading from, Mourning the Victims of the Cult of Israel, Land Back, Judaism Back. And the following week, December 14th, we will host Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb. So, John Michael Greer says, if you want people to get nothing done but conflict, convince people they're on two sides. What two needs is three, which is the unifying story. And our ally Irwin, Rabbi Irwin Keller, wrote his poem so long ago, long in this quirky time. October 17th is when he wrote it, and it was published in the Jerusalem Post, which is pretty conservative. he says, today I am taking sides. I am taking the side of peace. Peace which I will not abandon, even when its voice is drowned out by hurt and hatred, bitterness of loss, cries of right and wrong. I'm taking the side of peace, whose name barely been spoken in this winterless war. I will hold peace in my arms and share my body's breath, lest peace be added in the body count. I will call for de-escalation even when I want nothing more than to get even. I will do it in the service of peace. I will make a clearing in the overgrown thicket of cause and effect so peace can breathe for a minute and reach for the sky. I will do what I must to save the life of peace. I will breathe through tears. I will swallow pride. I will bite my tongue. I will offer love without testing for deservingness. So don't ask me to wave a flag today unless it's the flag of peace. Don't ask me to sing an anthem unless it's a song of peace. Don't ask me to take sides unless it's the side of peace. I go, ah. So we're going to play a clip in a moment. It's Christian Amanpour asking a question of UN Secretary, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffiths, and here we go with that clip.
So you have been, you know, on the front line of this since the beginning, but you've also been, you know, UN Special Envoy and advisor to many, many, many issues. Yemen, Syria, you've been in UNICEF, you've been doing this for a long time, head of relief operations, NGOs, the whole lot. Have you ever seen anything like this? Well, how do you assess what's happening right now in terms of humanitarian needs in Gaza?
The worst ever, Christiane. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, I started off in my 20s dealing with the Khmer Rouge. And you remember how bad that was, the killing fields and so forth. But 68% of the people killed in Gaza are women and children. They stopped counting the numbers of children killed after 4,500 had been counted. Nobody goes to school in Gaza. Nobody knows what their future is. Hospitals have become a place of war, not of curing. No, I don't think I've seen anything like this before. It's complete and utter carnage. Number two, the numbers, 11,000, 13,000, whatever it is, in Gaza, killed. The numbers displaced. 4 out of 5 people alive in Gaza displaced. 1.6 million people no longer at their homes. I mean, of course, you can understand why Israel would want to challenge these figures, because they are so horrific, and they have led to such a global reaction. Gaza, it is a global crisis, as you know. It's not just a crisis about Gaza. It's a crisis about humanity. It's a crisis which affects politicians across the world. It's a crisis which brings people out onto the streets in great numbers. And it's a crisis which destroys our faith, built up over many decades, that war should not be the first option. And I'm terrified to see that in this case, that's not true. War has become the option of the day. And the suffering that comes from it is astronomical.
So that is on our council table. And I'm here, we're all humbled by horror. You know, so we welcome to the traveling now that we're all in. I'm burning mugwort. Mugwort is a wonderful plant, sacred all over the world, sacred in the Ukraine. It's the burning of it, which I'm doing right now for all of us, is it protects boundaries, and it's about dreaming. It's safe enough to dream. And I dreamed that last night. I dreamt about lighting the mugwort safe enough to be to dream. I go, yes. So we are here with everything we can pull together that we are safe enough to dream. Henry Kissinger just died. Rolling Stone has an excellent relieving obituary. Henry Kissinger, war criminal beloved by America's ruling class, finally dies. Right, and the Yale University historian Greg Grandin, author of the biography Kissinger's Shadow, estimates that Kissinger's actions from 1969 through 1976, a period of 8 brief years when Kissinger made Richard Nixon's and then Gerald Ford's foreign policy as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, meant the end of between 3 and 4 million people. That includes crimes of commission, he explained, as in Cambodia and Chile, and omission like greenlighting Indonesia's bloodshed in East Timor, Pakistan's bloodshed in Bangladesh, and the inauguration of an American tradition of using and then abandoning the Kurds. And I have all links and radio notes on my Patreon. If you want the Visionary Activist Show, you can find all radio notes and all article links and all of that. So, yes, and Martin Griffiths just referenced, you know, I saw the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, but this is worse than anything. But we call upon Anthony Bourdain, ancestor now, alas, who says, once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands. You will never again be able to open a newspaper and read about that treacherous, prevaricating, murderous scumbag sitting down for a nice chat with Charlie Rose or attending some black tie affair for a new glossy magazine without choking. Witness what Henry did in Cambodia, the fruits of his genius for statesmanship, and you will never understand why he's not sitting in the dock at The Hague next to Milosevic. So there's always this conversation going. I remember an ally, now ancestor, alas, J. Arnell, noting that when the Ayatollah died, at the exact moment he gave his last breath was the carnage in Tiananmen Square. And he said it was as though kind of... And so Gaza and Kissinger, you know, in some quirky dynamic. Next week's guest has much to say, Shambhavi Sarasvati. She says, be brave and construct a life with your deepest values front and center. I call it yes. And then her bold essay on Israel as a cult. And we go, so she wrote an essay. Again, the link is on Facebook. The link is on Patreon, Visionary Activist Show, like mourning the victims of the cult of Israel. So it's bold, and we want boldness. So she says, dear friends, my parents and grandparents were all Jewish. My grandparents came to the U.S. in the 19th and early 20th centuries, escaping pogroms in the Baltic states and Ukraine. At various points, I've been asked to publicly express compassion for the loss of life in Israel on October 7th, and one Jewish student said, I don't understand why this is so hard for you. That student was not wrong. It hasn't been hard for me to feel compassion for those Israelis who lost their lives or were taken hostage, but I have only reluctantly expressed that publicly for various reasons, including that I feel moved to give all the public space now to Palestinians. But I've also come to feel that where Israel is concerned, there is something more painful than what happened on October 7th. something that includes October 7th, but is bigger than that, something that I mourn much more deeply, the cult of Israel. One of the most profound learnings for me since October 7th is the extent to which Israel as a state and Israel as an idea together function as a formidable reality distortion field. I now see Israel as a powerful supremacist cult. I mean this literally, not metaphorically. As a cult, Israel manipulates, seduces, rewrites, and suppresses histories, and silences dissent. It tortures, kills, and imprisons without cause. It peddles influence, consolidates power with bogus religious justifications for its existence and continuance, proselytizes with monetary and emotional rewards to gain new adherents, and threatens and denigrates those who dare to leave. Only under the constant generation of threat can Israel garner billions of dollars a year in foreign aid. Israel's need to maintain, the dehumanization and demonization of the Arab other speaks to Israel's need to maintain a perimeter, not of safety, but of threat. Threat is essential to maintaining Israel's core identity and brand as the only safe space. So I interject here momentarily. Part of our themes that we've been working together is, you know, we know that it's not a question that the Israeli state created Hamas back in the 80s, dragged the blind sheikh out of prison, funded Hamas as a foil for Arafat to keep Palestinians divided so they couldn't possibly advocate for peace or a two-state solution. So just right there in our dream news, we go, tyranny is addicted, must have an enemy, must create an enemy. So what we've been, the grieving, you know, is for grieving to take place across all borders, the kinship of the grieving, betrayed by leadership, you know, betrayed by Netanyahu, Israelis betrayed by Netanyahu, Palestinians betrayed by Hamas and their collusion. Although everything is more nuanced and complex, we add that to everything. But so the essay continues, only under the constant generation of threat, right, tyranny needs threat, can Israel garner billions of dollars a year in foreign aid, mostly from the U.S., attract new adherents, and justify its aggressively militaristic, settler, colonialist culture. Only the projection of constant threat allows apartheid to thrive with fear, ignorance, and pain as its fuel. This is classic cultism and consummate gaslighting. Remember, me interjecting again too, people use the term gaslighting all the time, and I do recommend the movie Gaslight, from which it came, because it's about how do you make someone crazy? You make somebody crazy by denying the truth. Just so in that sense, it is apt. Back to the essay. I find the cult of Israel terrifying in its relentlessness and terrifying in its cruelty, not only towards the other, but also towards its own adherents. Life in the reality distortion field. I have learned so much over the past 6 weeks from dissenting Israeli voices in Israel and Jewish voices elsewhere, from Jewish analysts in the U.S. and Europe, and from deep dives into histories, documentaries, thought papers, and sociological research. I interject again, we're all getting educated. We're all getting educated. There are so many sources that we will reference and that I'll put in the Patreon Visionary Activist thing. And then it's also just out there, too. She says, if you want a place to start, I recommend two documentaries, Tantura and Israelism. I've also learned from listening to liberal and progressive Jewish people who've had more of a Jewish education than I did. I've learned from listening to students who had a Jewish religious upbringing and went to Hebrew school. I've learned from highly educated Jewish friends who identify as leftist, or at least progressive. I've learned from postings from self-identified progressive Jewish people in Israel. What I've learned is that for the most part, being liberal or progressive or even supporting Palestinian self-determination does not protect Jewish people around the world from being impacted by Israelis' cultic reality distortion field. This impact is evident in unexamined narratives of only safe space and right to exist, and we deserve a homeland, and Israel has a right to defend itself, and Israel is surrounded by anti-Semitic enemies. It is also evident in powerful emotional ties to an idealized Israel and an idealized Zionism. I interject again, highly recommend Gabor Mate's, interview in which he delineates and says, you know, I was a Holocaust survivor as a little baby, and I grew up discriminated against in Hungary, you know, where a friend, when I was being picked on, said, oh, don't pick on him. He can't help being Jewish. And Gabor says that's how it was phrased, right? And then I became a Zionist, he says. And the dream of an Israeli state, how beautiful, how beautiful. But then I learned that our dream is someone else's nightmare. And he goes on, right? It is evident in attempts to separate Jewish Israelis from the Netanyahu government with statements such as, the people are not the government. While there are many Israelis who don't support Netanyahu, most Jewish people are well-versed in narratives of how ordinary German people enabled the Holocaust. Why would it be different in Israel? And this obfuscates the fact that Jewish Israelis are some of the most racist people in the world. Okay, we take a breath. Most are avidly in favor of the war on Gaza, and the huge majority of them support nationalist Zionism, either in full or to some degree. We're going to bring in some miracles, but this is important to say. It is also evident in the resistance to decentering anti-Semitism in the face of someone else's pain. It is evident in lingering, sometimes unconscious assumptions that anti-Semitism is worse than other forms of racism, and the inability to feel real feelings for other people's genocides or to fully acknowledge them. It is evident in the appalling lack of knowledge of Israel's history, the history of Zionism, and the history of the occupation of Palestine. Right, we're all getting educated. We're all getting educated. Taking the place of real histories are Hebrew school and Jewish cultural narratives that come straight from the reality distortion field. And as one Israeli analyst living in the West noted, Jewish people living in Israel are the least knowledgeable about their own history because it has been violently withheld and suppressed. Right, you can't mention the term Nakba. Israel's cultic reality distortion field is evident in the uncritical reception of the Israeli government and military's reports on the war, which have proved again and again to be deceptive in the most gross ways. It is evident in the shaming and oustering of those who deprogram and speak truth to power. And we interject and go, speak truth, be power. And it is most evident in the overriding narrative of Israel as being under constant threat due to anti-Semitism alone, without analyzing Arab relations with Israel in the context of settler colonialism, forced expulsion, and the incremental genocide of Palestinians over the past 100 years. Coming out to love. In a sense, this letter is a coming out. I'm saying some things I've held back since childhood, and also many things I've only recently learned. I interject, we're all getting deconditioned. We're all getting deconditioned. That's why we're in the traveling now. But it's mostly to say to my Jewish students and friends, I see you and feel for you as you question and grapple and re-examine what you've held dear or perhaps held and didn't know you were holding. I feel for the death of ideals and childhoods and things that you've loved and connections that may be in danger of breaking. I feel for the difficult reckonings and conversations that may not even be possible. I feel for the generations of Jewish people who've been denied knowing the real history of Israel well, who have been emotionally manipulated, who have been lied to, and whose pain and trauma have become pawns in an international game of the powerful and even the anti-Semitic. I feel for the anguish of Jewish people whose direct and indirect experience of genocide are being used to justify more genocide. The deepest mourning I feel is for those Israeli Jews whose lives have been given over to some of the most virulent racism on the face of the earth. They've become deadly caricatures of the demonic faces they project onto others. Their lives have truly been taken from them by a vortex where trauma and fear and what can only be called a kind of insanity have turned everything upside down and where reality cannot be discerned. Looking into the abyss. It may not happen today. It may take many more years. But I believe that with this latest phase of the Nakba, Israel has signed its own death warrant. We'll come back to that. There will be no safety and no recovery. Israel is self-destructing from the inside due to its own hubris, extreme racism, and militaristic culture. It has lost touch with reality and with anything that could be called worship. Unfortunately, it has taken live streaming the genocide of the Palestinian people and the utter decimation of their land and homes for Israel's absolute untenability and the bankruptcy of Western capitalism and neoliberalism to be revealed to the world at large. But this has been revealed, and it won't be veiled again. Cosmopolitanism. I've moved around a lot. I keep thinking about what usually happens when people move to a new place. People who move to a new place are generally eager to assimilate. They learn the language and the customs. They make friends. They try new foods and explore the lands and arts. They preserve the culture and life ways of wherever they came from, but they create a new, mixed life. Before Great Britain issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, Palestine was occupied by the Ottoman Empire. Arabs, Muslims, and smaller populations of Jews and Christians living together, sharing cultures, sharing daily life, sharing a common language, Arabic. Palestine was a cosmopolitan region, and for the most part, new immigrants, including Jewish immigrants, were welcomed. The Balfour Declaration announced the British government's support for the Zionist goal of establishing a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Along with the growing influence of nationalist Zionism, the Balfour Declaration is what initially encouraged the earliest land grabs by new Jewish settler colonialists and the first displacements of Palestinians by Jews from their ancestral homes. With this latest round of ethnic cleansing and genocide, Israel has completed the task of digging itself into a deep, no-exit pit. It's hard to see now where a viable solution might lie. The possibility of a two-state solution has receded into a hazy imaginary future. We're going to come back to that. But I do know that the constant pressure coming from ordinary people and activists around the world is having a profound effect. We are inch by inch changing the course of the 100-year war on Palestinians. In my ideal world, there would be a return to a more cosmopolitan form of life with Palestine returned to Palestinians. In other words, land back, and Israeli Jews and Jewish people around the world would step out of the reality distortion field in great numbers. They would rise up and courageously dismantle the narratives of safe spaces and right of return. In other words, Judaism back. It's hard to see the next steps, but we the people are proving to be the most powerful players. Let us all be in our hearts and actions, Palestinians, with infinite love. Shambhavi. So that's an essay by Shambhavi Sarasvati, who will join us next week as guest. We go, whew, all right, there's a lot to work with there. And so we continue. So powerful essay, much to work on, and it brings up the astrology of Israel. So Israel was born May 14th, 1948. Ben-Gurion's dinner, in which he announces it at 6:10 p.m., is what I have. And the sun then was at 23 degrees of Taurus. Transits. You know, the beautiful, exquisite language of astrology is an exquisite language of our interior psyche, or in this case, the interior psyche of Israel, and its separation by a thin membrane we call identity from the whole huge, giant cultural and biological conversation as evidenced or as proffered by the movement of the planets. So the outer planets, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, represent huge forces of nature's evolutionary intelligence. They are deconditioning transits. We are all in this deconditioning. So Uranus is nature's evolutionary trickster genius. It likes impossible things. It likes equality. It is a coyote. It is raven. It is seeds that sprout after cataclysm. It is the most unlikely desirable thing that could possibly happen. It likes impossible things against all odds, and that is the dance that the Israeli chart is having. And so to everyone, we go, you know, astrologers or not, just to entertain the possibility, what would it mean to be liberated? As with anything that we're dancing with, either we Well, Rumi was a great astrologer, and he said, when fate and forged a cross in the sky, you cannot escape it. Your only hope is to run towards it with embrace, right? Either we dance with it or it happens to us. Now, this transit is ongoing. You know, it began August and September into October. October 7th is Putin's birthday. Just keep that in mind. He likes to, it's all nefariously connected, you know, the warmongers and how our decent, you know, humans and the rest of the earth being played, we wonder. But so, to everyone, you know, what would it mean to my dream council news? You know, I go, what would be liberating? Well, liberated from this current government, perhaps. You know, we'll get to that. Heather Cox Richardson, may she be praised forever, you know, her essay, Letters to an American, every week. But she points out that Netanyahu, you know, part of his right-wing cabal is threatening to leave him if the carnage is not resumed. And it was postponed today, again, inch by inch. We're on this with mugwort. There we go. Wait, pause, so many, more than pause. And so what Heather says is, part of his right-wing cabal is threatening to leave if the carnage is not resumed, and that would require an election. And Netanyahu cannot afford an election. His popularity is at 27%, and he's been found guilty of corruption. Prison awaits. So we all gather in effective onstage action, whatever we can do, and backstage atmospheric artistry. We go, so we'll return to that, but drawing upon everything, and all the poignant parts of us, the good parts of humans. But I would say also just at the end of Shambhavi's essay, and her website is jayakula.org, jayakula.org. And she says, see the 100 Years' War on Palestine, a history of settler colonialism and resistance by Rashid Khalidi. And Sim Kern is somebody I love to follow on Instagram. Sim Kern, K-E-R-N. I highly recommend it. Again, links on Patreon. All radio notes are on Patreon for those who subscribe for even just a minimal thing. So Sim Kern will have a book event online with Rashid Khalidi. And if you go to her Instagram account, she's got many videos of reviewing the book chapter by chapter. I go, right. So macro to micro, teasing our tender concern for all life into play. We will come back for that. But our break music, you know, our middle music really, is again Bob Aziz, The Dance of the Atoms, right? Just to remind us. And when there's too much Mars, we go to Venus, the beauty of the Middle East, the beauty of Jewish culture and tradition. So many great rabbis, so many Jews for Peace, so many, you know, Norman Finkelstein, so many Gabor Mate, so many kin, really truly dedicated to collective well-being. You know, and the music of the Middle East and this wonderful, wonderful soundtrack from Bob Aziz, The Prince Who Contemplated His Soul, cannot recommend it highly enough. I often engage it because it is such an entheogenic song. The music of the Middle East carries such yearning, and yearning is salam shalom. Yearning is we're all in this together. We feel for you. We feel for the families on the borders. We feel for those in the Congo. We feel for those Israelis in fear and grief. We feel with Palestinians. We feel it is all one. We are with everyone. So as you listen to this music, just feel again, it's Neptune, oneness. You know, the presence of oneness, we are all connected. And in spiraling it into the atmosphere where it's available in this time of tripwires and hot reactivity, that we be agents of cool response in a hot reactive world. And this music really provides that. So again, as we listen, just even move your arms, you know, to waft this into the memosphere. We are all part of this dream together. Here we go.
ذره ها رقص کنند، آن کس که از او چرخ و هوا رقص کنند. جان ها ز خوشی بی سر و پا رقص کنند، در گوش تو گویم که کجا رقص کنند. هر ذره که در هوا در همون است، نیکو نگرش که همچو ما مفتون است. هر ذره اگر خوش است اگر محزون است، سرگشته خورشید خوش
That was the Dance of the Atoms, part of the soundtrack to the most marvelous movie, Bob Aziz, The Prince Who Contemplated His Soul. So beautiful. And the music of yearning, you know, grief and poignancy, our kinship to the deconditioned self, going, oof, you know, to bring us to our knees, like, oh, again, everywhere, wherever there's suffering, wherever there's, you know, grievance, may it dissolve into grief, which is kinship. And we do that for those who cannot be burdened with such a thing because they're under so much. You know, those of us who are ardently following, you know, just, well, everything in the Ukraine and everything in Gaza and everything everywhere, we all have our assignments, you know. But so many poignant stories. There was a woman who'd been interviewed by NPR a week or so ago, you know, and saying many things, but she said, oh, my children have seen such terrible things. We've seen body parts. I do not want my children to see such terrible things. And then we learned yesterday that she and her children have become body parts. And that she and her children and her parents, you know, and her grandparents, you know, all in one building, all taken away, you know, whole generations. Like, you know, we ask the dead for forgiveness, you know, and I am dedicated to redefining the word forgive as to mean to give energy for change. Because then, whom could we not forgive, including ourselves, for small infractions and large, you know, give energy for change. So we ask the dead for energy for change, you know, and for our tender concern for all life into play, the micro and the macro. And so Sarah Freely is a wonderful poet who has a book called Sad Math. And this wonderful poem that I'm going to read has gone, you know, spiral. I prefer spiral to viral. And yet she has not made a penny, right? So do check out Sarah Freely. Again, you know, website, Patreon, Visionary Activist Show, links to everything, you know, and buy her book. Why not, you know? But it's a micro. But may it resonate our hums. It's called Wondrous. She says, I'm driving home from school when the radio talk turns to E.B. White, his birthday, and I exit the here and now of the freeway at rush hour. Travel back into the past where my mother is reading to my sister the part about, it's Charlotte's Web, right, the part about Charlotte laying her eggs and dying. And though this is the fifth time Charlotte has died, I'm moved too. My mother is crying again, and we're laughing at her because we know nothing of loss and its sad math. How every subtraction is exponential, how each grief multiplies the one preceding it, how the author tried 17 times to read the words, "She died alone, without crying." 17 takes and a short walk, during which he called himself ridiculous. A grown man crying for a spider he'd spun out of the silk thread of invention. Wondrous how those words would come back and make him cry. And yes, wondrous to hear my mother's voice 10 years after the day she died. The catch, the rasp, the gathering up before she could say to us, "I'm okay." Right? So the micro, I remember, I'm remembering it now, reading Charlotte's Web. And it's again, children do know grief, not in the war realm, just from reading that little micro thing. So the chart of today is heartening. When we began, our rising sign was 11 plus Aries, whose image is wild geese. And so let's turn also to another ancestor of support and solace, you know, Mary Oliver's famous poem, Wild Geese. "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscape, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things." Well, thank you, Mary. Thank you, Mary. I was at a workshop once with her. I loved her. We shared smokes, and she's just a wonderful, quirky, great person. Many of her poems are dear to all of us. That is a particularly great one that the Chart of Now would like us to embrace and embody and feel its support. She also has praise, speaking of praise, you know, one of her poems, she says, "I sing in praise to this and that." And then it ends with, "I sing in praise to the coyote that came at me with its strong teeth bared and then at the last moment smiled." Which, those of us who know coyotes, that's very, very that. That's very, very that. And then just to dive into the chart of now, so heartening to us, right? Again, support. There is great awareness of danger, absolutely great awareness of danger. You know, so we have a beautiful, but so much beauty with which to cooperate. So awareness of danger. The sun and Mars and Ceres, Demeter, dwarf planet, goddess of the earth, are all aligned in the eighth house of ancestral download. You know, Mars's image is an owl seeing in the dark. It was the image for the full moon just behind us, which was a radical magazine circulating liberating ideas on behalf of the owl seeing in the dark, right? And one of the powerful things, I think it was Gabor Mate asking his interviewer, you know, "Do you remember, you know, Speer, the great Nazi war criminal?" And they were like, "Yes, yes." And when Speer wrote his memoir, he said, people were asking me, you know, "What did you know?" And he said, "That's not the question. The question is not what did I know, what could I have known?" You know, he said the German military that he was a part of, we're just saying, "You don't want to know what's going on in the East. You don't want to know." And he said, "I didn't ask." You know, so it's not what did I know, but what could I have known? And that's for all of us, for all of us. What could we know? You know, and the responsibility, opportunity to dive deeply, you know, deconditioned, going, what is the story here? So the Sun and Mars and Ceres, it's the Earth story. It's the Earth story. And the in Sagittarius, which is the realm of like storytellers, we live in a storytelling creation. Everything is telling us its story all the time by shape and color and song and rhythm. And if we just approach the world with informed, reverent curiosity, we humans would be okay. And the Sun and Mars and Ceres, Demeter, again, ardent for all, you know, has a 135-degree angle to the moon, which is a awareness of danger, awareness of danger. The moon in her own sign of Cancer, 20 degrees Cancer. The image for that degree is an operatic prima donna singing for a benefit concert. Quirky, yes, but many of us might remember or go out and read immediately Anne Pratchett's novel Bel Canto. It's a heartening resource. It's a powerful, powerful novel about a Latin American tyrannical dictator, but he loves opera, right? There's the Venus part. And so the officials get his favorite opera singer to fly into the embassy for his birthday, and terrorists invade, and they are all together for 2 months, and they come to love each other. I don't know if you've seen the videos of the most recent hostage releases, but the young girls and are, goodbye, goodbye. And the Hamas beings are like, goodbye, good luck, goodbye, good luck, bye, bye, bye. You know, Israeli government like, no, 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 none of that. Just cut that out, you know. But we go, right, you know, underneath everybody, again, whatever we speak to one another is the part of them we're being invited to dance. You know, and the Israeli military was like, and when we release Palestinian prisoners, you know, we want no expressions of joy, no laughing, no talking, no expressions of joy. And they're releasing, I mean, that's good, but people they'd arrested last month, right? So these are not so much Palestinian prisoners as hostages, right? Thousands, thousands of hostages of bargaining chips. And we rejoice. You know, and then the Israeli military was raiding the homes of the released Palestinian hostages, right? And we go, we turn to the art of peace, we turn to many things that can proffer this, and we go, okay. So the moon at 20 degrees of Cancer, and it's got a beautiful, exact 60-degree angle to Uranus. There's Uranus at 20 Taurus, whose image is a finger pointing to a line in an open book, getting specific answers to one's questions, the whole realm of divination. So divination and storytelling. And it's a beautiful, beautiful sextile that says, you know, underneath all of this human befoibelment, it says, humans, we cannot afford this superstitious, you know, dominating, you know, blood sacrifice as a horrific avoidance of the task before us, which is humans humbly cooperating with nature's guiding genius, the Earth story. The Earth story, we have plenty to do. You know, backstage says, you humans, you know, first, you know, many tasks, but completely redesign the human cultural interface with nature. Yeah, let's do that, all right, right away. And for all of us to dedicate, let us be agents in the culture on behalf of what we love. You know, justice and dedication to collective well-being and what we love in nature, because it's everything. This conflict is global. Anything that's anywhere is everywhere. The tyranny against community. When I began by saying, you know, tyranny hates community. And I go back, we go back in all of our lives to, you know, different things in South Africa, District 6, right, when I was there very long ago. But everybody referenced District 6 as though it had been yesterday, in fact, but not decades earlier. But it was a harmonious community of many, many different cultures and many religions and many people. You know, it's like people saying, you know, I remember, you know, my grandparents remember when Jews and Islamic beings, people lived in harmony, that we would always, you know, take our kids over to the Jewish families for them to look after when we had our high holidays, and they would take their kids over and we would look after that, just like that. Well, District 6 was like that. And the pre-apartheid South African government was like, can't have that, can't have actual harmonious community. No, tyranny thrives on conflict. So they evicted everybody. And the cab drivers, well, everybody, but the cab drivers are great storytellers. And they said, you know, but they couldn't build anything on the land, because whenever people went there to do something irreverent, some building project, they were haunted. They could smell the different flavors and spices of the cooking stoves that once were. They could hear the children from diverse backgrounds laughing and playing together, and they were haunted by their own shame. There we go, right? So again, community, this is going to be really, really important forever, and certainly for the next 24 years for sure, for us to discern the difference between a cult and a community. So here, you know, what we're being proffered, you know, what we're being, you know, offered is the Moon and Uranus going, nature's evolutionary genius, ingenuity. We love the feisty creative innovation of rebuilding going on in the Ukraine with, you know, hempcrete and regenerative farming in the midst of bombing and just yay life. You know, more mugwort, more safety in which to dream for everybody. And so the Moon, in her powerfulness, she trines Neptune right now. Neptune is a huge intelligence. We're all in this dream together. And Neptune's particular image for that degree is rooting out corruption from the priesthood. There we go. Again, the power of vision. You know, and it says all of us who are listening, all of us here participating in some way, we have the power of dreaming the world into being. You know, from the sacred teachings of the Kabbalah, right? We want all sacred teachings cleansed of tyranny, available, fresh, liberated, liberating everything, liberating Christianity, my friend Pat Ewing calls what she loves in Christianity, meaning setting it free and finding those parts of it that are liberating, liberating Judaism. So in the Kabbalah, right, they have a whole Neptune mystical riff, right? They say, you know, how, if the divine is everything, how does the divine create using nothing outside itself? And they said, well, by analogy, how do we create using nothing outside ourselves? And they said, in our imagination. So we are made in the image of the divine, not that we look like old men with beards. You know, we are dreamed up by the divine, and our capacity to dream and imagine together is the divine part of us. The responsibility, opportunity for dreaming the desirable world into being. And this, with the Uranus says, against all odds, could happen. You know, could happen in the flash of an eye, since we're in the traveling now, so it's always now. And the Moon is opposite Pluto, death and rebirth. America's in its Pluto return. Shall we have a democracy or try that? Let's try a democracy or not. You know, there's a lot on the table. I liked Rachel Maddow's, you know, town hall. She was pretty great at the end. She goes, it doesn't come to every generation, but it's come for us. This huge theme of tyranny or democracy, the danger to the earth, the danger to humans and all life, you know, tyranny or democracy, take your pick, right? And she said, you know, we all want to be good to each other. It was a rousing, good for you, Rachel Maddow. And some people, I can hear progressives going, ah, and it's like everybody's many things. Sure, I got grumpy at Rachel for her bad treatment of Bernie and that, okay, but we're the rousing, you know, within us all is the myth of the gathering of befoibled people who may have done terrible things, but who gather to do some impossible miracle thing together. You know, it's like, look, here's that person I couldn't stand, but they're coming over the hill with the other half of the seal. Honk if you have the other half of the seal. So everyone, we want to root way down deep into our kinship with the earth in order to rise to the occasion. Right, so, you know, the saying, tyrants don't care if they're hated as long as the people don't love each other. Tyrants don't care if they're hated as long as the people don't love the earth. Loving the earth, and that kinship underneath everything. And that's very, very, very in our chart right now. The Moon has a beautiful quintile, irresistible eloquence on behalf of the earth. You know, my friend Sylvia Hanley, wonderful astrology ally, you know, says the quintile is irresistible eloquence. You know, again, this is all being proffered to us so generously. You know, she said it's also the capacity to open portals between worlds and between dimensions. And we go, right, well, let's experiment. You know, believe nothing, entertain possibilities. Let's experiment. The whole history of storytelling, you know, the Death and Resurrection show by Rogan Taylor is, you know, going as far back. They go, it's people gathering, and very often it's a woman, but you know, not necessarily. Maybe it's a twin-spirited person. But calling in power, we don't source power, we invite it, and we offer it a template, a story. Come on in, power, and animate this. You know, I like somebody saying, let's follow Giving Tuesday with socially restructure everything Wednesday, and then we go, and animating the desirable guiding story Thursday. Let's keep that going. So, yeah, so the quintile, again, let's invite in, you know, our allies and support for impossible desirable things. And that's part of the strategy. And it comes from all sacred teachings in the Kabbalah, which is not to start with realism, not to start with how could we have a two-state solution? Oh, it's gone. We go, start with what? Start with, again, mugwort, safe enough to dream. What's the most beautiful, desirable story? Forget realism for the moment. That's the impediment of realism. What is the most desirable story? What is the vision of the earth blooming? Of, again, cultures blending in harmony, cooking stoves, children laughing, just all of these impossible things, right? Impossible, necessary miracles. And the language says, start with what? And Jupiter and Uranus say, we will do how? Do common sense things as they occur, because that's dedicated magic. And magic is a willingness to cooperate with everything, but not to let the compelling illusion of realism be an imaginative impediment. And this Jupiter-Uranus being so proffered to us, they will conjoin, they're very, very close together, they will conjoin at 21 plus Taurus on April 21st, 2024. But it's all around now. It's all around now. We do not fetishize one particular date. It's all in the atmosphere and entertain the possibility. But the two biggest path openers for a true, ingenious renaissance of the earth herself, guiding humans into accord, the crisis, is possible. The Jupiter-Uranus image, the Sabian symbol for that degree, is a white dove, flying over troubled water, and we go, ooh. The image right now, so it says, come up with the desirable vision, and there's so much opportunity to do impossible and miraculous things. And we go, all right, that's fine. I like another ally, Shekinah Mountain Water, says, make for yourself a power spot, bring you a spoon and a cooking pot, bring air, bring fire, bring water, bring earth, and you, a new universe, will birth. We go, that's really And then a wonderful kind of ode to the moon here by Patricia Monahan. There is a power in this world that we often fail to see. The power of the goddess, we can call it, or the power of the feminine, or the power of womanhood. In daily life, in the halls of power, on the front pages of the newspapers, even in the family, this power is often invisible or subjugated, yet it is always there, flowing through the world like a great river. Without it, not a single flower would ever set fruit. Not a single child would ever be born. It is inexhaustible. It is everywhere at once. It is incomprehensibly and inexpressibly great. This is the force and the power that stirs in every woman. Even when life seems to go against her, every woman partakes of the spirit of the valley, the power of the quintessential feminine. Chinese philosophy honors that spirit as part of the Tao, the great wisdom. We can do no better. Beneath the buzz of this world is the deep hum of the greater world. Beneath the strain and difficulty of yourself is the calm and strength of the greater self. Within you, there is a source eternal. Within you, there is the root of the transcendent. Even in times of great activity or great change, you can touch the gentleness of peace within yourself. Even when you are lonely, you can find solace within. There is within you all that you need. So then wonderful guest, Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, will be our guest on December 14th. And she has a beautiful thing. She's created, she says, I made this Shamarat Shalom painting in the wake of October 7th to strengthen my spiritual commitment to revolutionary nonviolence. There is no peace until all the children from the river to the sea are able to sleep in peace and dignity in their own beds without fear. Resist the culture of war. Practice a culture of peace. Healing intergenerational and communal traumas will take all of our strength and dedication. Ceasefire now, never again for anyone. Free Palestine. Plan for a future of peace. And she says, just very briefly, here we are. she says, in 2010, students from the Ramallah Friends School, Quaker school established in 1869, designed and led a delegation of Quaker youth from Philadelphia. I was honored to be part of this delegation, so deeply moving to travel with the group of students and painful as well. The young people we traveled with were kind, hospitable, curious, creative, and proud. I hope everyone understands that these three students who were just shot in Burlington, Vermont was a hate crime. Ceasefire there and ceasefire here. I stand in solidarity with my Palestinian cousins. I am so sorry, dear relatives. And her ally Bev Shalom says, my heart breaks for Hisham, Kinan, and Tassin. I can't wish for them to have a full recovery because, so sadly, that's not going to happen to all of them with love and solidarity. So, team, yes, think about what is liberation for the world, liberation for the earth. Think of Lilier's work, again, all being posted everywhere we can be. And thank you all. Thank always Kirsten Thomas. And we will reconvene next week with Shambhavi and more. Love and peace.